Milton Friedman and Ludwig von Mises obviously have some things in common. They're both economists. They both favor, in some broad sense, a free market. Mises tends to be more radical and thoroughgoing in his conclusions than Friedman is, but it's not as though they're on wildly different sides. But they are on quite different sides when it comes to questions of method. And I want to talk about two criticisms that Friedman has of Mises and of the Austrians more broadly, two methodological criticisms. And then ultimately I'm going to argue that both of those criticisms are based on the same mistake. So the first and probably the most famous criticism that Friedman makes of Mises and of the praxeological approach broadly is one that's summarized in the first quotation on your handout, although he said this many times, which is this. Friedman sees empirical observation, empirical testing, as the means to resolving disagreements. And he thinks that if you are following an a priori method, then you have no means of resolving a disagreement you have with some other economist who's also following this a priori method. Because, you know, you reason and you go through your concepts, you say, well, this seems self-evident to me. And the other person, they reason and they go through their concepts and they say, well, this seems self-evident to me. And you're each reporting different deliverances of self-evidence, different deliverances of your, you know, internal conceptual state. And you've got no way to resolve the argument except by, you know, yelling or arguing. Although he does mention trying to find a logical flaw in the other person's position, which you might seem like, you might think is, you know, a possible way through here. But Friedman just seems to treat that as, you know, on the par with yelling and arguing and fighting. Whereas when he suggests a more empiricist approach, which is that you say, all right, what empirical predictions does my approach make? What empirical predictions does your approach make? Let's go out and observe. So Friedman thinks that you can't resolve disputes among a priori thinkers because each one is sort of consulting their own private deliverances of their own reason. Instead, you can turn to the public world of empiricism, public world of experience, and test things that way. So he thinks that that a priorism, praxeology relies on a, praxeology as Mises understands it, relies on private sources of evidence that are not publicly testable, whereas an empirical approach relies on public sources of evidence that are publicly testable. Now, I think that here Friedman is confusing two different conceptions of self-evidence, logical and psychological. So a psychological conception of self-evidence is something is self-evident to you in the psychological sense, just in case you have this strong feeling of certainty when you contemplate it. You hold this thought before your mind, and you think, wow, gosh, yeah, that grips me. I can't find any way to deny it. It just takes over my brain. And of course, you know, some other idea might grip your brain in just that way, and I'm gripped by this, you know, this private thought in my brain, and you're gripped by this private thought in your brain, and of course, you know, there's no way of resolving it. But a logical conception of self-evidence is this is self-evident because it would somehow be logically incoherent in one way or another. There are different kinds of logical incoherence, but there'd be some kind of logical problem or some kind of conceptual incoherence in denying it. And logic isn't private. I mean, it's not empirical. You don't, you don't resolve logical questions by, you know, you don't resolve the question of whether something can be on the table and not on the table at the same time in the same respect by looking at the table and seeing if anything's doing that. You don't resolve it empirically, but it's not as though you turn your mind to some kind of private voice either. Logic is public. Same thing with mathematics. If I want to know whether 2 plus 2 equals 4, you know, I don't have to engage in the empirical process of counting things. I can reason it in my head. You can reason it in your head too, but it's not as though I'm turning to some private voice that only I can hear. Mathematics is public. Logic is public. And as far as Mises is concerned, praxeology is public too. It's not empirical, but it's public in the sense that it's, you know, it's equally accessible to everyone. So when Friedman just sort of slides quickly past this notion that one of the ways you could try to respond to the disagreement is by trying to find a logical flaw in the other person's position, well, yes, that's exactly what you do. If you have a disagreement between two a priorists, you just say, all right, well, the reasoning is publicly accessible. Let's go through the reasoning and see whether there really would be an incoherence in denying this or not. You know, one person claims this is an axiomatic thing you can't coherently deny. The other person denies it. Well, we don't have to do an empirical test. We can just publicly reason about it. Moreover, Mises, I think, actually goes farther than this. Mises thinks it's empiricists who are bogged down in inevitable disagreements unless they rely on a priori methods. And I have the second quote on the handout from Mises, where he says, "Disagreements concerning the probative power of experience can be resolved only by reverting to the doctrines of the universally valid theory." What he means is you need theory to interpret experience. And people who can look at the same empirical data and interpret it differently because they have different theories about it. And so you have to retreat. And so rather than saying all theory must arise from the evidence, from the empirical evidence, Mises thinks, no, there are some theories that you can figure out conceptually, make sense or don't make sense. That are necessarily true or necessarily false, just on the basis of conceptual reasoning. And then you often have to use those theories to interpret the data. So from Mises' point of view, two empiricists might be bogged down in some endless dispute as to whether something satisfies something or not. I mean, for those of you who heard Bob Murphy's lecture earlier today, where he's talking about... he gave this example of people who keep giving stronger drugs to the patients who keep getting sicker as a result. And one person thinks, well, the drug is actually a poison, and that's why the person's getting sicker. The other person says, no, we only give this drug to people who are really sick to begin with. And so it's no surprise that they keep getting sicker, but it's despite the drug, they would have gotten even sicker without it. Well, Mises thinks that there are some cases, certainly there are some cases where the only way you could resolve that is through more empirical testing. But Mises thinks there are some cases where the only way to resolve it is by appeal to economic theory that he thinks is conceptual. Okay, the other criticism that Friedman makes I want to talk about is one he doesn't direct explicitly to the Austrians, but the critique he makes is one that would apply to Austrians among others. It applies to everyone who criticizes mainstream neoclassical economics for excessive reliance on idealized models. Mainstream economics often relies on models of things like perfect competition, where everyone's assumed to have complete knowledge and information about prices transmits itself through the economy instantaneously, and you have infinitely many people competing so that everyone's a price taker and various things like that. And Austrians, among others, often criticize these models for being unrealistic, for describing some sort of Platonic, I use that term advisedly, Platonic world of ideals rather than talking about the actual world of where things take time and where there's ignorance and so on. And so Friedman has a very famous essay which he wants to defend the use of idealized models against the charge of being unrealistic. This is his 1953 article, "The Methodology of Positive Economics," which Hayek once said was, and that's the third quote on the handout, Hayek described it as, in its own way, as dangerous a work as Keynes's General Theory. And those are the two works he most regrets not having criticized. Because people often ask Hayek, why didn't you raise more criticism of Keynes's General Theory when it came out? And Hayek said, well, he regretted that he hadn't done it, but at the time he just thought that that, you know, Keynes seemed to have a different theory every week, and he thought this would just be one more flash in the pan. And then later on, he and Keynes were on the same side fighting against inflation, so it wasn't politics to do it then. And so he never got around to really attacking the general theory, and he regretted it. Likewise, because he and Friedman were allies, both involved in the Mont-Pelerin Society and so forth, he just didn't get around to attacking this paper or the book that it's in. And in retrospect, came to regret that. So, what is Friedman's defense of using unrealistic, idealized models? Well, he says, look, what would be the alternative? What would be a fully realistic model of the economy? A fully realistic model would be one that included all the information. So, for example, if you want to understand the grain market, you have to know the names of the farmers and how many freckles each one has and what color shirt they're wearing and so forth. And you just have to have a completely fully detailed list of all the information. But obviously that would be hopeless and pointless. First, it would be impossible. You couldn't possibly, you know. It would be like saying, I want the painting of the person to have as many, have all the same properties as the person. Eventually, it couldn't even be a painting. It would have to be a sculpture. And the sculpture would have to move, and eventually you just have to clone the person if you wanted to make a painting of them. It's hard to do. But also, it's pointless. You don't need all that information because, says Friedman, what models need to do is to be good predictors. The importance of a model is not that it's an accurate description of reality, because no model, no abstraction, can be fully accurate. You always have to leave stuff out. You leave out how many freckles the farmers have, or whether they're left-handed or right-handed, you leave all that stuff out. Instead, you want an account that will predict. What happens if you have a model that predicts the right stuff? Doesn't matter if it's if it's unrealistic. Now, in this respect, Friedman actually goes farther than many other like-minded people, because there are lots of people who think that models should at least be an approximation to, or some kind of vague description of the reality that they're trying to explain. But Friedman doesn't think that they have to be. He thinks, as far as he's concerned, your model could be completely, wildly unrealistic. It could describe, describe things as having properties that bear no resemblance to anything they have, as long as it's a good predictor. Now, how should an Austrian respond to this criticism? Well, I think there's several different points an Austrian would want to make. Of course, one is that the information that a lot of these models leave out is precisely the information that, from an Austrian standpoint, is crucial to explaining what's going on. So, for example, lots of Austrian accounts are based on the fact that there's imperfect information and asymmetric information, and that the effects of various things passes through the economy slowly over time and affects some things more than others. I mean, the whole account of the business cycle depends on accounts according to which people are getting mistaken information from price signals. They're drawing the wrong conclusions from price signals. Then other aspects of Austrian monetary theory. Think of Cantillon effects, where the injection of new money into part of the economy hits a certain part first and thus causes an artificial boom over here, and then later trickles through the economy. I mean, the fact of imperfect information, or think of the Austrian accounts of entrepreneurship, where being a better predictor under uncertainty brings you success, and where you move the market forward by finding asymmetries of information. This person is selling apples for $5 each. This person's buying them for $6 each. So you rush in and find them here and sell them there. I mean, all that depends on asymmetric information. So the very things that these models tend to leave out are things that for the Austrians are crucial for explaining things. Another criticism is that Austrians have a different conception of what it is to explain things from what Friedman has. For Friedman, prediction is what it's all about. That the task of economic theory is to predict what will happen. Not to explain, you might talk about explaining things, but by explaining things, he means broadly, bringing them under regularities such as allow prediction. Whereas for Austrians, to explain economic behavior is to understand it in terms of, what ends are being pursued, and how does people's pursuit of these ends bring about these further results? There's a famous story about Mises talking about Grand Central Station. You see all the people rushing about, people zooming here and zooming there. Unless you understand that these people have plans, and they are enacting their plans, and they're pursuing ends, and they're pursuing and using applying means to pursue these ends, and in doing so, they're interacting with other people and so forth. Unless you understand things from their subjective perspective, you don't have any idea what's going on. You might formulate some sort of statistical regularities about it. You might discover that, that certain times of day, the number of people zooming through the station is higher, and other times of day it's lower. You think you found an empirical regularity? No doubt you have, but you haven't really explained something if you don't understand what they're there for. You don't understand that they're there because this is a way of getting somewhere else, and they're trying to get somewhere else, and they're buying tickets or to get on a train to go somewhere, or they're meeting someone. If you don't understand that, you won't know why it's higher at some times of day and lower at others, and also you won't know. You won't have as good an idea. You won't actually be that good at predicting either, because you won't know whether you've discovered a general law or some kind of temporary regularity, unless you understand the reasons for these things. An example I like to give is, suppose that in 2001 you formulated the theory that there is a constant force that produces a Tolkien movie every year. And if someone says, but there's no such force, you say, yeah, I know, but, realism isn't what matters here. What matters is predictive power. 2001, out comes a Tolkien movie. 2002, out comes another one. 2003, out comes another one. And you think, well, cool, we've got a good regularity going here. But unless you understand what's actually causing it, you'll be surprised when there isn't one in 2004. And, now if that had happened, that theory would have gone out of date. And then now with the Hobbit movies, it would come into, the theory would be revived again. Oh, maybe we don't know what happened before, but now the force is working again. And again, there'll be good predictions. You give them a three, and then there'll be disappointment again. And they'll say, oh, there's some force that produces a series of three every few decades. And then they'll be wondering why in 2022 or something, there isn't another trio, assuming there isn't. The quote on the second page from philosopher Peter Winch is from a book of his called The Idea of a Social Science, where he makes a similar point to the one I was making about the trains, which is, if you hear people speaking language, you won't understand it. Well, suppose you develop some kind of statistical rule for predicting what sound they're likely to make next. So you figure out that, after someone has said the following 18 syllables in a row, you predict that there's a, 48% chance that the next five syllables will be such and such. Would you say that you therefore understood their language? And the point that Winch is making is, no, he has the last line. A man who understands Chinese is not a man who has a firm grasp of the statistical probabilities for the occurrence of the various words in the Chinese language. Mises often criticizes earlier thinkers for having mistaken views about abstraction. He doesn't always put it this way, but I think this is a way of understanding what's going on. In particular, I think it'll help us to see that there are two different ways that abstraction can work and that Friedman is conflating two of them. Mises often refers to the fact that early economists often thought of themselves as dealing not with all of human action, but just with, you know, the economic side of phenomena. And Mises complains that he found even Bumbaverk still in something like the grips of this theory. When Mises was developing his monetary theory, and he was bringing it to his old teacher, and for Mises, for example, Cantillon effects, or Cantillon effects, there's a dispute as to exactly how he would have pronounced his name, since he spent, you know, half his time in France and half his time in Ireland. But anyway, Cantillon or Cantillon or however he pronounced it, the Cantillon effects are the effects that come from the injection of new money into different parts of the economy at different times. And Bumbaverk said, well, that's all true in principle, but that's just like friction. Really, if you want to understand the effects of inflation, you know, you can really treat it sort of the way Hume does in his famous essay of imagining that all the money in everyone's pockets doubles overnight. What would be the result? And suppose that everyone knew that. Well, of course, then if everyone's money doubles overnight and everybody knows it, it actually has very little effect on the economy. Again, I suppose it might make an effect, some difference on some contracts that specify something being paid in a certain amount. But anyway, no one would become generally richer or poorer because everyone would know that everyone had twice as much money, but the amount of goods had not increased, and so basically the price of everything would simply automatically double. And that's the way to understand how inflation works. And Bumbaverk was saying, well, you have to, you know, that's sort of what's happening ideally. And just as, you know, physical objects don't perfectly follow the laws of mechanics because there's friction, so they slow down or they don't go quite as fast as they would otherwise. But you just ignore those for analytical purposes. So likewise here, and Mises was frustrated by this. Mises was also frustrated by Max Weber's attempt to treat economic concepts as ideal types, which Mises quotes Weber here as involving one-sided intensification of one or several aspects. You know, so for example, and this connects with this idea that economics is only about what the businessman does. The businessman is someone who is concerned solely with maximizing his monetary profit. And, you know, people would often say, well, of course we know that real-life businessmen are not concerned solely with maximizing their monetary profit, but we're talking about the business side of their lives, where that sort of approximates to what they do. It's a reasonably good predictor for what they do. So this is a less radical position than Friedman's, because they thought that approximation mattered, not just prediction, but broadly so. Now, Mises is not against, you know, ideal types or idealized models in all purposes. He's against using them to model the actual economy. Now, take the evenly rotating economy, which is this, this construct that Mises uses that is unrealistic. He has no objection to constructing an unrealistic, perhaps even impossible, scenario, but the purpose of it is not this makes a good model of the actual economy. The whole point of the evenly rotating economy is that it's not like the actual economy. It's a simplified version that allows us to grasp more easily the difference between, for example, profit and interest, because the difference between profit and interest can be difficult to identify. If you can manage to construct some, because often there'll be returns that might be some sort of blend of profit and interest, it's hard to tell which is which, but you construct some imaginary scenario in which profit exists but interest doesn't, then helps you, and you see why that's the case, and helps you understand the concept. So he's not against having these idealized models. His point is these idealized models, their function is not to serve as pictures of reality. So I think the best way of understanding what Mises is doing here is to place him in a tradition of the Aristotelian tradition of abstraction as opposed to Plato. So there is this dispute in ancient Greece as to whether abstraction falsifies. You know, whether when you consider something abstractly, you are somehow thereby misrepresenting it. You know, so take, for example, two things that are very much alike. These two plastic cups. Very similar. So we could come up with a general description that covers both of them. But nevertheless, there are differences. I mean, obviously, the most obvious difference is location. This one's over here, this one's over there. But I'm sure if you examine them closely enough, you could find some difference. Like this seems to have a scuff mark here. This one doesn't seem to have one there. No doubt, if you went down to the molecular level, you'd find different, you know, arrangements and so forth. They're not exactly alike. But we use a concept that applies to both of them. Some might say, well, isn't this falsifying? And the more urgent question for the Greeks, because of their love of mathematics and geometry, was, well, aren't those falsifying? You know, in geometry, we talk about planes and points and cubes and so forth. But in physical reality, we never encounter anything that is a perfect sphere or a perfect cube or a perfect triangle. Because perfect triangle is a, you know, its three borders are lines with zero thickness. And we've never seen anything with zero thickness. If it had zero thickness, we wouldn't be able to see it. So the worry was that these didn't correspond to reality. Plato's famous answer is, well, they correspond to an ideal reality, to a reality of forms. There are forms that perfectly answer to our concepts, our abstractions. But they're not in the physical world, and we don't experience them through the senses. We grasp them solely through the mind. And then objects in the physical world are merely imperfect representations, imperfect approximations to those perfect things. So mathematics and geometry don't fully apply to the real world. Well, real world, that's what Plato would think. I was being tangential in saying, putting it that way. They don't apply to the physical empirical world fully. They do sort of approximately and vaguely. Mathematics and geometry apply with perfect precision only to the realm of forms. And likewise with all kinds of concepts. For example, the concept of equality, two things being exactly alike. Plato says, well, in reality, nothing is exactly alike in the physical world. But the form of equality is exactly alike. What does that mean? Exactly like what? Like itself? Like something else? Well, Plato seems to think that it's just alike. True alikeness isn't relational. It's relational only as we experience it. Anyway, Aristotle, Plato's student, although he learned a lot from Plato, he thought Plato was wrong about this. Aristotle said, no, we can say that abstractions apply to reality and to the actual physical empirical reality. The way they do it is that geometry doesn't deal with ideal lines off in Platonic heaven. It deals with real lines here on Earth, but it abstracts from their thickness. It focuses only, for example, on a line's length and not on its width. Geometry is true of the line. Geometry isn't about things that lack these physical properties. It's about the physical things, but considers them only insofar as they have certain properties. Considers certain physical objects only in respect of their length and not in respect of their width, and so on. Well, then, in the wake of this, in the Aristotelian tradition, we get a distinction between two kinds of abstraction, which in later centuries came to be called the distinction between precisive and non-precisive abstraction. And I have on the fourth page, I didn't quote for everyone, but I have sort of Aquinas as a stand-in for for the Aristotelians here. So there are two ways you can form an abstraction. One is that you can start from something in the real world and then imagine something that doesn't have those properties. So for example, I might start imagining you. You have a physical body, but you also have a mind. I could form the concept of a being that has a mind but no physical body. I focus on your mind, I imagine that, but I imagine the absence of a physical body, and then I form a different concept, say a spirit or an angel or something like that. That concept does not correspond to the reality I based it on. You are not a disembodied mind. Now, it might correspond to something else, or it might not. There might be such things as disembodied minds, or there might not. And if there are, my concept might apply to them, but it doesn't apply to you. I based the concept, let's say, on you, but I didn't, but it's not accurate of you. Considered as a description of you, it's a falsification. But there's another way I could form a concept. I could simply focus on the fact that you have a mind and not pay any attention one way or the other to the fact that you have a physical body. So it's not that I form the concept of something that has a mind but no body. Rather, I form the concept of something that has a mind and I don't think one way or the other about the body. In that case, my concept does apply to you because you do have a mind. And I haven't specified the absence of a body. I've just failed to specify anything one way or the other. I've given an incomplete description of you. But it's perfectly true. And likewise, then, I could describe properties that these two top cups have in common. They would be perfectly accurate. It would apply to both of them. And I would leave out various properties, but I wouldn't specify that I didn't have them. Just as if there are two horses, one is white and one is red, and if I formed the concept of a horse that had no color, then it wouldn't apply to either of them. But if I just form the concept of a horse and I leave out any reference to its color, that would be a non-precise abstraction, that would apply just fine. So I have Aquinas drawing this distinction. I have Charles Comte, an early French classical liberal, sort of in some ways proto-Austrian theorist using the same idea. I have Franz Brentano, Aristotelian thinker, and then I have Ayn Rand, all quoted here, who all making essentially the same point. I mean, I'm sure they would disagree on the details, but on this page, they're all making this point that from the fact that you have to distinguish between concepts that specify the absence of some property and concepts that simply fail to specify the presence of some property. For example, suppose someone's asking me to describe this room. And so I just say, well, there are a bunch of people in it and a bunch of tables and chairs. And someone says, well, I've left out the fact there's a lectern and there's some water and there's a clock and there's this blue backdrop and there's some cameras and, I've left out and oxygen. I've left out all kinds of things. But they didn't make my description inaccurate. My description was incomplete because a complete description would take quite a while. But it was perfectly accurate. And if I'd said there are people, tables, and chairs in the room and nothing else, that would have been inaccurate. That would have falsely described the room. But I didn't specify that those things weren't there. I simply failed to specify that there were. So you can begin to see how this applies to Friedman's worries about about a fully realistic model having to talk about the eye color and the freckles of the farmers. No, it can leave that information out. It shouldn't just specify that it's absent. And likewise, in principle, a model of the economy that left out, didn't rely on, or didn't make any point about differences in knowledge wouldn't be false. It might be not very, very useful if the things it's leaving out are the things you need to explain. But it wouldn't be false if it simply leaves it out. The problem with perfect competition models is they don't just fail to specify the presence of these things. They specify their absence. It's not just that they don't say that the things have the properties. They say that they don't have them. They describe them falsely. So there are ideal models in Austrian economics. Even the rotating economy is an ideal model. It specifies as absent certain things like ignorance and uncertainty and change that are present in the real world. But the laws of praxeology are non-precise abstractions. They're abstract. They leave out lots of information. But they don't misdescribe things. They simply describe things at a certain level of abstraction. And there's nothing wrong with that. Now, what I want to argue is that Friedman's criticism of realism, this stuff about abstraction, and his assumption that abstraction always has to falsify, is rooted in the same mistake as his critique of a priorism, which is psychologism. Now, the concept of psychologism, although it may not necessarily have been invented by Gottlob Frege, a late 19th, early 20th century logician, his critique of psychologism is one that sort of made the concept famous. And by psychologism, essentially, he means the confusing of logical relationships with psychological ones. So he drew a famous distinction of what he calls the three realms. There are two things you could ask about any object of knowledge. First, you could ask whether it's sensible or nonsensible. That is this something that we know through the senses, or do we have to know it through some way that doesn't involve the senses? The other question we can ask is whether it's public or private. Is this something that only I can know, or is this something that, you know, we could all jointly share in knowing? And this creates, you know, four possibilities. Something could be private and sensible, public and sensible, private and nonsensible, public and nonsensible. So I have this grid here. I've drawn an X through the upper left box because Frege doesn't think that's a possible combination. He doesn't think something could be a private object of knowledge and yet knowable through the senses, because the senses are precisely what put us in touch with this physical empirical world around us. So if something is knowable through my senses, it should be knowable through your senses too, and therefore it's not private. But there's some things that are public and sensible. And this is what he calls the outer realm, the realm of, you know, physical objects. This table is sensible. We know this table by looking at it, by experiencing it through the senses. And it's public. I can see it, and you can see it. We all have equal access to the table. The table is common property, not in a legal or moral sense. It belongs to the Mises Institute. But in the epistemological sense, it's common property. It's available for all of us to see. Then there's stuff that is private and nonsensible, which Frege calls the inner realm. This is my thoughts. I've got various thoughts. I don't know them through the senses. It's not through he wouldn't use the term thoughts because he wanted to reserve that for something else. But, you know, inner conscious experiences. I don't know them through the senses. I just know them just by having them. But you can't know my mental states directly, Frege thought. You know them indirectly by inferring them from my outward physical behavior. But you can't peer into my mind. You can't have direct access to my mental states the way that I can. Now, Wittgenstein would later challenge that, but that would take us too far afield. So mental states are private and nonsensible for Frege. But Frege thought there's a third realm, which is things that are public but not sensible, and that's the realm of concepts and logic and mathematics. Those things are public. We can both, if I'm thinking about tuples equals four, you can think about the same tuples equals four. I don't have my own private tuples equals four, and you have for yours. And then my two and two equal four, and then yours, you know, might not, or something like that. Well, there's just one tuples equals four for all of us. You know, Plato was right about that. Frege thinks Plato was wrong to treat these concepts as some sort of, you know, being like physical objects except super ethereal and glowy. But I thought it's right that there are these, you know, publicly accessible conceptual contents. interestingly enough, it's hard to know whether Mises was influenced by Frege or whether he had read him. But Mises does also attack what he calls psychologism, and he footnotes Husserl, and Husserl got it from Frege, so this is at least indirect influence. But anyway, Mises talks about the word psychology because there was a time when people suggested calling the Austrian school the psychological school. Mises says, well, actually, this is ambiguous. And so he comes up with these three different terms. There's naturalistic psychology, which studies human behavior insofar as it's susceptible of empirical methods, insofar as it's like physical stuff like neurophysiology and reflexes and that kind of thing. That, you know, in other words, it's psychology devoid of subjectivity, where you're not concerned with how the world seems to the person and what their take on it is. You're just concerned solely in overt physical demonstrations. Then there is what Mises calls themology, a term he coined, which comes from the Greek word thumos, which means something like spirited anger, which is more narrow than what Mises had in mind. But he meant it as he wanted a word for Greek word for spirit that wasn't already being used for something else, and so he took that. And this is the realm of thoughts, and Mises didn't think there were any laws about this. And there's praxeology, which is deals with those aspects of human action that are capable of being grasped a priori. You know, so Mises would say that the fact that the fact that I always apply my first unit of a good to its most highly valued use for me would be a fact of praxeology. It's something that would apply to all actions because it would be conceptually incoherent for being anything else. You know, the fact that the first item of good I get, I always put in a purple box, would not be something you could know through praxeology. And interestingly, these three aspects these three kinds of science of human action correspond fairly neatly to these three Fregean realms, the inner, outer, and third realm. And when Mises attacks positivism and historicism, he does it sort of in terms of these three kinds of sciences. So the problem with positivists is they treat human behavior as though it could be grasped through the kinds of natural laws that apply to physical objects. That is to say, they don't try to understand human behavior from the standpoint of the subjective perspective of the person. You know, if you want to understand what the people in Grand Central Station are doing, you have to know how it seems to them, what their goals are, what their beliefs are, to understand it. You can't just treat them as a bunch of, you know, billiard balls zooming around, or you won't understand what's going on. So that's the positivist error, to treat themological sciences as though they were naturalistic. But there's a different historicist error. The historicist he gives credit to for and by historicist I don't mean the Schmollerite historical school. He thought that they didn't get anything right, but later people that he talks about in the book Theory and History, he says that they were correct to see that the right method for understanding human behavior is taking this subjective perspective, but they were wrong in not seeing the existence of praxeology. They thought there was just themology. All there is to human behavior is just, people happen to want things, but what they want might vary from person to person or from era to era, and so there's no way you could have any reliable generalizations about human action, whereas Mises thinks you can with praxeology. Now, what I want to suggest is that Friedman is guilty of psychologism, that is, of confusing the logical with the psychological, the third realm with the inner realm. And one of the ways that this is manifested is, if you confuse the logical with the psychological, you're likely to confuse the act of thinking with the content of thinking. Because acts of thinking are private. I've got mine, you've got yours, and they're multiple. If we're both thinking 2 plus 2 equals 4, I've got something happening in my mind, you've got something happening in your mind. Those are different mental processes. But their content is the same. We're both thinking 2 plus 2 equals 4. I don't have my own private 2 and 4. We have a common public content, but the mental process itself is different. Now, if you don't mind that distinction, you don't keep track of that distinction, then it's easy to think that any absence in anything that's omitted from the act of thinking must be omitted in what's being thought of. And so, if I'm thinking of a horse and failing to think of its color, a reference to color is absent from the act, then I must be thinking of a colorless horse. And then it's going to seem as if all abstraction falsifies, and all abstraction is precisive. And that's going to lead Friedman to make the mistake he makes about thinking that in order to have realistic or accurate abstractions, they have to be completely specific. Which, of course, they don't. Describing something as a poodle is not more realistic than describing it as a dog. Describing it as a dog is not more realistic than describing it as a mammal. Those are all equally realistic. The more vague descriptions are just as realistic and just as true. They just give less information. Perhaps the information they leave out can be left out without harm. Perhaps it can't, depending on what you want to do. But likewise, if you confuse logic and psychology, you can confuse the privateness of the inner realm with the publicness of the logical realm. It's going to seem to you that appeals to the a priori are appeals to something like a private voice. You think, well, I'm appealing to these concepts in my head. And I think that would help to explain why Friedman thinks that if you're appealing to sort of conceptual evidence, you're appealing to a private voice that for which there's no public verification. Now, I want to close by suggesting that Mises may make the same mistake as Friedman in a different area, which is in the area of objective ethics. Mises famously thinks that ethics has to be subjective. And what that means is not just that people's actions always have to be explained in terms of their subjective perspective. That has to be right. We thought that all subjective perspectives were equally valid when it comes to value. Now, he didn't think that when it comes to belief. He thought you had to explain people's different actions in terms of their own differing beliefs. But he didn't think all beliefs were equally true. Some people have false beliefs, and as a result, they end up doing the wrong thing. But he did think that all values, all basic ultimate values, were equally, there was no objective basis for distinguishing among them. But notice what argument Mises gives for this. He thinks that, according to them, cognition of justice is imparted to man by an inner voice, that is, by intuition. The champions of this doctrine did not pay attention to the fact that people can and really do disagree with regard to the interpretation of the inner voice, and that no method for peacefully settling such disagreements can be found. There is no rational means available for either endorsing or rejecting a doctrine suggested by an inner voice. What Mises says here about the moral philosophers looks a lot like what Friedman says about Mises. Namely, there's no peaceful way of settling a dispute based on different people having different interpretations of their inner voice. Mises doesn't seem to be taking seriously the possibility that someone might believe in an a priori ethics, not in the sense of believing in the deliverances of inner voice, but thinking that some ethical conceptions are coherent and others are incoherent. Some we can make sense of and some we can't, logically. It's not that he's considering those theories and then rejecting them. or saying that they don't, the arguments don't seem to work, he just seems not to have that possibility on his radar. It's off his radar in much the same way that what Mises is doing is off Friedman's radar. So I think that in defending Mises against Friedman's objections, we may also be opening a space for doing a kind of ethics that Mises is not considering. Okay, questions? We've got about 7 or 8 minutes for questions. Yes? Well, I've got the quote somewhere, which I could tell you, but also if you just search for any of those lines in order on Google, it'll come up, because almost all of Mises' works are online, mostly on Mises.org, although a few of them are somewhere else, but I forget which works that's from. I've got an article that goes through some of this stuff, and that I may have the citation there. I forget which parts of this are in the article and which aren't. Yes. Well, that's tricky. I mean, there's certainly something praxeological going on in Hayek, or at least in early Hayek. If you look at stuff like the Facts of the Social Sciences or the Counter-Revolution of Science, he is interested in conceptual relations among various concepts of action, as is Mises. Now, I think, there's this whole dispute as to whether Mises thinks that these are analytic or synthetic a priori, and there's some passages where he seems to say one and some the other. Here's how I think it works for Mises. And I don't think there's anything precisely corresponding to this move in Hayek, but for Mises, the action axiom, I think what's special about it is that it's what establishes that this whole structure is actually grounded in reality. And there's an interesting metaphor. It's actually in Hazlitt. It's in the Economics in One Lesson toward the end, although hardly anyone ever quotes this passage. But Hazlitt talks about the concepts of economics all being related to each other, like circuits all being plugged into each other. And all you have to do is just plug one of them into reality, establish that one of them has reality, and the whole thing lights up, as he puts it. Well, I think that the role of the action axiom is in a way to plug all these into reality, because you could establish various conceptual relations among concepts without knowing whether they apply to reality. I could have concept of a unicorn and the relation of the unicorn to its horn and so forth, and I could come with various things that would be sort of hypothetically true about that, but not know whether there are any unicorns. Likewise, you might say, all right, well, you could define action as the application of means to ends, so you know that if something is acting, then it's applying means to ends, and then various further things apply to that, like that it's going to apply the first unit of any good to its most valued end, blah, blah, blah. But you might say, how do I know that any beings actually act at all? How do I know that this isn't just an elaborate science fiction story that I've made internally consistent? How do we know that any of this applies to reality? I think they have the role of the action axioms to do that. Now, Mises sometimes describes the action axiom as being the claim human beings act. And I'm not sure that's the best way of of putting what he has in mind, because human being is a particular biological category. I don't think it's a priori that any particular biological species acts. I think what's a priori is that I act, or we act, or action exists. Because the existence of action is something we can't deny, because denying action would be an action. So I think it would be one of these performative contradictions, that to say no actions exist is like saying no assertions exist, which is, you've asserted it. Now, it's not contradictory, in the sense you can imagine a world where there are no actions. You can imagine a world that just consists of rocks floating in space, and that's it. That's the whole universe, just rocks in space. It's kind of like, Descartes, I think, therefore I am. When he says, my own existence is a priori, he doesn't mean a universe without me is inconceivable. Of course, I might not, you can imagine mine not existing. I may once have not existed. In the 19th century might have been a time when there was no me. But I can't assert my own non-existence because I'd have to exist in order to assert it. So I think that the fact that you can't deny the existence of action without making an action shows that action is real, that action happens in the world. And that means that there are such things as means and ends and so forth, and then you therefore get all the rest of it. Now, which other concepts apply? Like in monetary theory, there could be societies that don't use money. So it's not a priori that a given society is going to use money. What's a priori is that if they're using money, then various further things follow. It's not a priori which other beings are conscious agents either. That's something we have to figure out through thymology, really, which is fallible. We can make mistakes about interpreting other. Just as we can make mistakes about what other people are thinking and planning, we can make mistakes about whether something is thinking and planning or they're just a cleverly designed robot. But Hayek said the same thing. Kirzner once said, "How do we know that other human beings are conscious?" He asked Mises. And Mises said, "Oh, we just observe and infer that." And Kirzner said he was surprised. He thought that Mises was going to say we know it a priori. I don't think he should have been surprised. Now, Hayek doesn't really have anything corresponding to the action axiom. I don't know that he would deny it, which is it doesn't play any particular role in his thought as far as I can see. Yes. Hayek was certainly a bigger fan of Popper than Mises was. I think he was less big fan of Popper than Friedman was. Hayek seems like a Popperian to a Misesian, and he seems like an anti-Popperian to a Friedmanite. It's one of those in-between things. Because I remember some interview where Friedman said, Hayek always claimed that he learned from Popper, but really there was a basic level of Misesian a priorism that he never fully got rid of, which from Friedman's point of view was a bad thing. I think that Friedman and Hayek took different things from Popper. As for the context of this quote from Hayek, it was in an interview, and he didn't go on to elaborate exactly what he would have criticized about positive economics. I have no idea whether his criticisms would have overlapped at all with mine. Although I do know that Hayek certainly thought that you need to understand actions in terms of people's intentions and so forth. So he wouldn't have liked the hyper idealized models. Sort of the Hayekian criticism of macroeconomics is always that it's sort of praxeologically opaque. It's microeconomically opaque. You've got these big aggregates, but they don't really reflect what anyone is actually planning or intending. Yes?
What about Rothbard? Because I heard that Richard Gordon said that within agreement with Mises about this praxeology or whatever, even though he was
Rothbard and Mises disagreed about the basis of praxeological knowledge. Mises thought that it was inherent in the structure of the human mind, so that we necessarily experience everything in terms of it. Rothbard thought that it was, in a very broad sense, empirical, that we, just by experience in the world, we pick up these concepts, though not empirical in sort of the narrow way of doing experiments or statistics or something, but just something we pick up from general experience. So they disagreed about the status, but they didn't disagree that much on the content. I think that should probably be the last question. So, thank you.